Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 95. It's Monday, January 4th, 2021. Happy New Year. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Thank you for visiting the People's School of Public Health and the University of Life. Okay, well, let's deal with COVID and get that out of the way. Of course, we have a slow vaccine rollout. I don't want to focus too much on the details, but General Perna, who is the director of the Operation Warp Speed Logistics part, was blaming the weather for not getting vaccines out to people, which seems to me kind of missing the point. Mailing or shipping the vaccines is not the bottleneck. The bottleneck is getting it into people's arms. They can mail them to states or several parts of every state. It's after that that's the real bottleneck. This, again, is another kind of fundamental misunderstanding that the Trump administration has had in its approach. Now, hopefully that will, of course, end soon. And Congress did finally approve $8 billion for vaccine distribution. This is the amount of money, basically, that was requested in order to do that. Of course, this would have been helpful 6 months ago, or 3 months ago, or 2 months ago, or a month ago. But I suppose better late than never. Of course, the ongoing story with COVID-19 is the so-called UK variant. I've been annoyed over and over again in looking at media reports, and they keep asking the question with some naive optimism that, oh, well, this doesn't increase the deadliness. And again, from a medical point of view, yes, if you get the virus, this new virus variant or the old variant, for you as an individual, it's not any deadlier. But if you ask the question, as a pandemic, is it deadlier? Oh, yes. So we're really talking about infectiousness versus deadliness or the case fatality rate. But of course, if you have more infections, you're going to have more deaths, therefore more deadly. I kind of liken this, if you want to take one metaphor, it's like having a sniper aiming at you. And the sniper may all of a sudden become 70% more accurate, but the weapon he's using is no more deadly. Of course, you are going to be scared of that sniper a whole lot more, because while the weapon itself is no more deadly, you are more likely to get shot. And bring it even more mathematically, since you're really multiplying two things to get the deadliness from a public health point of view, from a pandemic point of view, it's kind of saying, okay, before we were dealing with 10 times 10 equals 100. Now we're moving 70% higher infectious rate. 17 times 10 is 170. But people saying, well, 10 times 10, 17 times 10, the second 10, that's the same. So, we should take great comfort in that. Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Okay, well, I'm here to give you perspective and point out the differences between the narrower view of medicine and the broader view of public health. Okay, well, in this new year, what can we expect for COVID-19 in 2021? Well, I certainly hope that it's a better year, but we have no guarantee of that. Of course, this UK variant, with its increased infectiousness, will very likely complicate and worsen our ability to get a more complete handle on this virus. Plus, you never know, there could be additional mutations and new strains could further worsen the pandemic. The more replication you have, in other words, the more uncontrolled the pandemic is and the more viral replication you get, the more chance you have for additional mutations. And of course, if there's anything we've learned from this vaccine, from this virus in the U.S., is that we relax when we feel slightly less threatened. And I expect that as the vaccines roll out, we will compensate, or perhaps more poignantly, overcompensate with relaxed other prevention measures. And to the point with that, this news story from NBC, U.S. air travel hits pandemic high over New Year's holiday amid surging COVID outbreak. U.S. air travel hit its highest level on Saturday since mid-March, raising fears that the spike in holiday travel result in another surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths in upcoming weeks. Even as the coronavirus rages across the country, nearly 1.2 million people passed through security checkpoints at airports on Saturday, according to the Transportation Security Administration. And Anthony Fauci told us, this is what happens. It's terrible, it's unfortunate, but it was predictable. Okay, well, may the new year bring a little more predictable rigorousness in our prevention efforts. So a big question really to ask this year is, will we achieve in the United States herd immunity in the year 2021? And I suppose a sub-question of that would be, would we be able to do that by the fall when schools are supposed to go full board and hopefully have the potential of going in person? Well, this depends a lot on the length and strength of immunity that's afforded to those already infected, in addition to those who actually get a vaccine. Now, we know that it seems that if you get infected with COVID-19, that you likely cannot get infected again for at least 8 months. But we don't know how long that is. Is that a year? Is it a year and a half? Is it two? But if we get more than a year of something near full protection, then a combo of vaccine and acquired immunity through infection could get us to the neighborhood of herd immunity. Of course, this herd immunity is going to be affected by this new variant, which I think undoubtedly will become much more widespread and be the dominant variant. So if you have a more infectious strain, you're actually going to need a higher percentage of people that are vaccinated or have acquired immunity through infection in order to slow or stop infection in the community. And of course, as of yet, we don't have any vaccine approved for kids under 16. One of the two so far has been for 16 through adults. The other was 18 plus. And of course, there's always a certain percent, usually in the single digits, of people who can't or shouldn't get a vaccine for a variety of reasons. Okay, well, let's say we even as a nation, as a whole, across the board, the average immunization is actually at herd immunity rates. That does not necessarily mean that it's herd immunity in every region or locale of the U.S. So actually, we could have a place where, again, you're 2 or 3 or 4 or 20 or 100 different little Americas, these pockets, or what you could call herds. So it depends which herds you're traveling or living in. So you could very well have some of these more recalcitrant, resistant rural areas, for instance, where you're not getting near herd immunity and you're finding the virus continues to rage on. And of course, that bounces back and forth, you know, into urban areas. But if, say, in urban areas, a particular urban area has herd immunity, then it will the virus will have a hard time getting a foothold into those communities, but it may cause a smaller outbreak. So I expect that the chance that we will have a functioning herd immunity over the entire country is probably unlikely. Maybe in much of the country, I'd say about 50-50, but we're going to have to wait and see. We will know hopefully a lot more about this in 3 or 4 months. Of course, we say that a lot. We're learning a lot as we go along, but there's still a lot we don't know. Okay, well, let's do a local update. For Lucas County, the average number of daily cases over the previous 7 days has stayed relatively stable. It dropped slightly. It's down to 230 reported infections, identified infections a day. Of course, our testing has gone down to record low levels that we haven't seen in months and months. Our positivity rate is kind of incalculable because they're not reporting the total number of tests. The negative tests apparently are not being reported for weeks and weeks. We're down to about 330 tests per day, where we were doing 400, 500, 600, 700, 800, 900 in the last couple months. And we're seeing in Ohio, the test positivity rate is creeping back up. I last reported it at 13%. The new number is 14.6%. And this is part of a smaller number of total tests performed than the previous week, a slight decrease. And we remain at the lowest weekly testing volume in Ohio since October. A little bit of good news on the local front, though. In Lucas County, the average turnaround for getting a positive test result to the health department has gone down to 3.4 days, which was a pretty big improvement from 4.5 days turnaround the previous week. But as I said, the total test performed is holding at the lowest levels in months and months. And this may represent some good news in the bad news of testing being very low, is that labs may be catching up in their capacity report more quickly to the health department. Okay, well, let's look at our riskiest population, those in nursing homes, long-term care facilities. We saw the number of active cases go from 214 to 219 in the most recent week. This is split about evenly between staff and residents. Residents, a little more likely to be an active case. We're seemingly having slow reporting on this. That might just be the thing with the holidays. But we had a 17.2% positivity in the most recent week, but we don't have that updated except for a couple weeks ago. Okay, and some good news. The Lucas County death rate dropped over the holidays in Lucas County. Now we have a similar death rate as the state and actually less than the national death rate. We had a total of 38 deaths in the last 14 days compared to last weekend. I reported we had 52 deaths in the previous 14 days. Okay, well, the last month I've been looking at this, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. They give hospitalization and ICU occupancy by COVID-19 status. But the data has been kind of up and down. There's been missing data, so it's hard to compare week to week. And also makes me a little bit unsure about how accurate it is. About the best I could extract out of this, if you look at the last few weeks of data for Lucas County for adults in an ICU with a COVID-19 diagnosis, 2 weeks ago we were at 152 over the week. Last week we were at 176. This most recent week we're at 249. So that's an increase of 50% in the last 2 weeks. So that's a little disconcerting. For schools, Lucas County Schools and the University of Toledo are out of school, so they don't have any reporting. But the new thing we're reporting now for the second week is vaccines started. We don't have vaccines completed because all the vaccines we have take 2 doses, and nobody in Ohio has gotten a second dose yet because it's been too recent. But Ohio moved up to 162,942 people vaccinated, reported as of today. This represents 1.39% of Ohio's population. Lucas County has 7,361 people with their first vaccine dose as of today reported. And that's 1.72% of Lucas County's population. So, as last week, Lucas County is doing somewhat better in the rate of vaccination. So, go Lucas County. Okay, well, that ends it for the local COVID-19 report. And now I like to switch gears and do some New Year's resolution related reporting. We have two things. At the end of the year, we got the new dietary guidelines that have been updated. And I would like to talk about tobacco use and quitting tobacco use, since tobacco use is the single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S. And, of course, about two-thirds of smokers over any given year want to quit at some point. So, let's see if we can help that along. But first, let's start out with diet. This, I'm going to do a little bit of reporting from the American Heart Association. This article, Federal Dietary Guidelines Emphasize Healthy Eating Habits But Fall Short on Added Sugars. The American Heart Association, the world's leading voluntary organization focused on heart and brain health, responded to the 2020 through 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Health and Human Services. This new dietary guidelines emphasize the importance of healthy eating and encourage Americans to, quote, make every bite count, said Dr. Mitchell Elkind, president of the American Heart Association. We are pleased that for the first time, the guidelines provide recommendations for pregnant and breastfeeding women, as well as infants and toddlers, underscoring the importance of maternal health and proper nutrition across the lifespan. The new guidelines, like earlier versions, stress the importance of adopting a healthy dietary pattern that is rich in fruits, vegetables, and legumes, and includes whole grains, lower non-fat dairy, seafood, nuts, and unsaturated vegetable oils, and low in consumption of red and processed meats, sugar-sweetened foods and beverages, and refined grains. The guidelines are consistent with the American Heart Association's dietary recommendations, and they show that a high-quality diet at every life stage can promote health and reduce the risk of diet-related chronic disease. But we are disappointed that USDA and Health and Human Services did not accept all of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee's science-based recommendations in the final guidelines for 2020, including a recommendation to lower added sugars consumption to less than 6% of calories, Dr. Elkin said. Added sugars can include refined fruit juices, corn syrup, and other added refined sugars. The largest single source of added sugars in the U.S. diets is sugary drinks, which contain excessive calories and no additional nutrients and contribute to weight gain and diabetes. Many adults and children have little room in their diet for empty calories and need to go lower than 10% to have a healthy dietary pattern and meet their essential nutrient needs. It is important to recognize that the guidelines are just a first step, Elkin said. We need policy and environmental changes to ensure consumers can easily access healthier food. This requires collaboration among the food industry, government agencies, health organizations, and consumers nationwide. Our hope is the Biden administration will prioritize nutrition, and all nutrition-related policies will reflect these new recommendations. It is important that these new guidelines are integrated into future school meal policies and regulations to ensure the health and well-being of our children. The guidelines also recommend reducing saturated fat intake and replacing it with unsaturated fats, particularly polyunsaturated fats. A lower intake of saturated fat and a higher intake of unsaturated fat can lower incidence of cardiovascular disease for individuals. Additionally, lowering saturated fat intake is likely to result in a lower intake of dietary cholesterol, since cholesterol is commonly found in animal foods that are high in saturated fat or consumed with foods high in saturated fat. Sodium is another key area of interest to the American Heart Association. Reducing excessive sodium intake, of which 70% comes from processed, prepackaged, and restaurant foods, is critical, reducing cardiovascular disease risk. And one they don't cover here, another scientific recommendation that was rejected from the scientific review panel was moving the recommendation for alcoholic beverage consumption. First of all, if you're not drinking, do not take up drinking. But if you are drinking, for men, they wanted to reduce that from two drinks a day to one, the recommendation. Basically, the evidence in recent years has shown that, alcohol doesn't do anything for your health. There used to be some confusion thinking that moderate amounts of alcohol might actually help with cardiovascular disease, but that's been disproved over the years. So they were reluctant to take that recommendation for whatever reason. And you have to understand that these dietary guidelines are also taking not just what I would call nutritional science from kind of a biological point of view, the nutritional science, but it also takes in kind of behavioral and cultural considerations about kind of like what's feasible to even recommend, which kind of complicates it. Like, for instance, they recommend that half, at least half of your grains consumption be whole grains. Of course, it's better to have the more than that, but they know that because so few people even meet that half requirement, it's kind of a compromise right out of the gate. So you just have to recognize that they're not trying to be that aspirational. They're trying to kind of more nudge than give you kind of the hardcore what's really the optimal diet. Okay, well, you can get this entire report plus a lot of extra materials, including materials for consumers, at dietaryguidelines.gov. And I just wanted to review they had two pages of tables in here that give you some examples of calories in food choices that are not nutrient dense and calories in nutrient dense forms of these foods. To give you just a couple examples of what they're talking about, the changes that would be healthy to make. So the first one would be, instead of having an 80% lean ground beef patty, 3 ounces, you could cut the calories basically in almost in half by using a 97% lean beef rather than the 80% lean. 80% is kind of your standard hamburger. 97% would be a really lean beef. So the 90% lean beef 3 ounce hamburger would have 122 calories, but the regular 20% fat or 80% lean hamburger would have 209 calories. So the additional 87 calories is basically just beef fat, which doesn't add anything and actually is detrimental for an addition to your diet. Next one, sort of similar, would be like fried fish. So if you took breaded fried cod, 4 ounces versus baked cod, the baked cod would have 99 calories. The breaded fried cod would have 230 calories, so more than twice the calories a lot more fat. Okay, whole milk versus fat-free milk. For a cup of fat-free milk, it's 83 calories. For a cup of whole milk, it is 146 calories. So you're moving from, you get an extra 63 calories of milk fat by having whole milk versus the fat-free. Okay, another classic one would be popcorn. If you're having a couple cups of movie-style popcorn with butter, that 2 cups would be 184 calories. If it was air-popped, you'd have 62. Now, of course, a lot of people are not going to eat air-popped popcorn. But what I like to do is I actually have a little popper machine, but you could do it in a large pan as well yourself. Just put a minimum amount of oil. And you can kind of experiment with what works. I mean, it doesn't take much to pop it, but you can kind of experiment with taste. And you can also control the amount of salt that you put on there as well, which would likely you can find something as tasty as less salt than what would be in a commercially produced kind of instant popcorn. Okay, the next one. Comparing a full-fat mocha, 12 ounces, to an espresso with fat-free milk. The full-fat mocha, 12 ounces, has 290 calories compared to an espresso with fat-free milk when I have 110 calories. So getting close to 3 times as many calories, because when you're doing the full-fat mocha, you're adding an extra 79 calories of milk fat and an extra 101 calories of chocolate syrup. An espresso with fat-free milk could be pretty tasty too if you like such things. Okay, another example, sweetened applesauce versus unsweetened applesauce. If you just take a cup of unsweetened applesauce, it's 103 calories, but when that's sweetened, they add another 67 calories for a total of 170 calories, and that's all just added sugars. I don't know about you, but I find plain unsweetened applesauce plenty sweet. Okay, in the other chart, they have a couple other examples for making nutrient-dense choices, one food or beverage at a time. They give an example of like frosted shredded wheat versus just plain shredded wheat. And I would say, of course, you're talking both calories and nutrient density. But if you want to make your plain shredded wheat as an example, or an unsweetened cereal, in fact, I used to do this for a number of years. I would have plain shredded wheat with raisins and walnuts. Very tasty, very healthy. Another one that's real popular as a health food is yogurt. But many, many people instead of buying plain low-fat yogurt and adding their own fruit, they get full-fat yogurt and they have which is mostly added sugars, but added fruit. It's much like adding jam or jelly, which is mostly sugar, to yogurt, and you add a lot of calories and dilute out the amount of actual healthy yogurt with a bunch of sugar. Okay, and for canned goods, they give the example of canned beans, but it could be canned anything. Instead of getting the regular canned thing with a, quote, normal or regular amount of sodium, get a lower sodium alternative. Good way to cut down on the amount of salt or sodium you get. Another very simple substitute is, instead of using butter, use vegetable oil. I'd say if you're looking for a little additional taste, olive oil is a good substitute for a lot of things, but certainly health-wise, using a more unsaturated fat is a very healthful choice. Another obvious one, instead of using a sugary soda, use sparkling water as a substitute. And you can, again, get this report and additional materials related to it at dietaryguidelines.gov. Okay, well, in resolution territory, let's move into quitting tobacco. This from the World Health Organization, more than 100 reasons to quit tobacco. I'm skipping a few of them, but this is a long list. Okay, tobacco causes 8 million deaths every year. When evidence was released this year that smokers were more likely to develop severe disease with COVID-19 compared to non-smokers, it triggered millions of smokers to want to quit tobacco. Quitting can be challenging, especially with the added social and economic stress that have come as a result of the pandemic. But there are a lot of reasons to quit. The benefits of quitting tobacco are almost immediate. After just 20 minutes of quitting smoking, your heart rate drops. Within 12 hours, the carbon monoxide level in your blood drops to normal. In case you don't know what the problem with carbon monoxide is it preferentially binds in place of oxygen on your hemoglobin. So you're basically starving your body of oxygen. And this, in the long run, this leads to heart attack. Well, it can trigger heart attack in the short run too. So you actually reduce your risk of heart disease literally in half a day. Within 2 to 12 weeks, your circulation improves and lung function increases. Within 1 to 9 months, coughing and shortness of breath decrease. Within 5 to 15 years, your stroke risk is reduced to that of a non-smoker. Within 10 years, your lung cancer death rate is about half that of a smoker. Within 15 years, your risk of heart disease is that of a non-smoker. If that's not enough, here are a few more reasons. And I just want to add, I'll repeat this again at the end, in Ohio, if you want to get expert assistance in quitting smoking, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, the first category. Smokers have a greater risk of developing a severe case and dying from COVID-19. Bum, 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 bum. Second category. Tobacco affects your looks almost immediately. Everything stinks, from your skin to your whole house, your clothes, and your fingers and breath. Tobacco causes teeth to yellow and creates excess dental plaque. Smoking tobacco and the use of smokeless tobacco cause bad breath. Tobacco makes your skin wrinkly, making you look older faster. Smoking prematurely ages the skin by wearing away proteins that give the skin elasticity, depleting it of vitamin A, and restricting blood flow. These wrinkles are more apparent around the lips and eyes, and tobacco also makes skin leathery and dry. Tobacco smoking increases the risk of developing psoriasis, a non-contagious inflammatory skin condition that leaves itchy, oozing red patches all over the body. It threatens the health of your friends and family, not just you. Over 1 million people die every year from exposure to secondhand smoke. Non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke are at a risk of developing lung cancer. Cigarettes remain an important cause of accidental fires and resulting deaths. E-cigarettes also expose non-smokers and bystanders to nicotine and other harmful chemicals. Being exposed to secondhand smoke may increase the risk of progression from tuberculosis infection to active disease. Being exposed to secondhand smoke is associated with type 2 diabetes. Smoking or using e-cigarettes around children compromises their health and safety. Smokers' children suffer reduced lung function, which continues to affect them in the form of chronic respiratory disorders in adulthood. School-aged children exposed to the harmful effects of secondhand smoke are also at risk for asthma through inflammation of the airways to the lungs. Children under 2 years of age who are exposed to secondhand smoke in the home could get middle ear disease, possibly leading to hearing loss and deafness. Quitting smoking decreases the risk of many diseases related to secondhand smoke in children, such as respiratory diseases such as asthma and ear infections. Tobacco use has negative social consequences. You want to be a good example to your kids, friends, and loved ones. Tobacco can affect social interactions and relationships negatively. Quitting means there are no restrictions on where you can go. You can mingle socially without feeling isolated or having to go outside to smoke. Quitting can make you more productive. You won't have to stop what you're doing and have to smoke all the time. It's expensive, and you could be spending your money on more important things. One study found that smokers burn through an average of $1.4 million in personal costs, including spending on cigarettes, medical costs, and lower wages brought on by smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke. Tobacco use affects the health and productivity of workers, making them prone to missed days at work. Tobacco use contributes to poverty by diverting household spending from basic needs such as food and shelter to tobacco. Tobacco use burdens the global economy with an estimated $1.4 trillion in healthcare costs for treating the diseases caused by tobacco and lost human capital from tobacco attributable sickness and death. Smoking reduces your fertility. Smokers are more likely to experience infertility. Quitting smoking reduces difficulty getting pregnant, having premature births, babies with low birth weights, and miscarriage. Smoking can cause erectile dysfunction. Smoking restricts blood flow to the penis, creating inability to achieve an erection. Erectile dysfunction is more common in smokers and very likely to persist or become permanent unless a man stops smoking early in life. Smoking also diminishes sperm count, motility, and shape of the sperm in men. All forms of tobacco are deadly. Every year, over 8 million people die from tobacco use. Tobacco kills half of its users. Use of tobacco in any form robs you of your health and causes debilitating diseases. Chewing tobacco can cause mouth cancer, tooth loss, brown teeth, white patches, and gum disease. The nicotine in smokeless tobacco is more easily absorbed than by smoking cigarettes, enhancing its addictiveness. When you buy tobacco, you are financially supporting an industry that exploits farmers and children and peddles sickness and death. Tobacco growers are exposed to ill health by nicotine that is absorbed through the skin as well as exposure to heavy pesticides and exposure to tobacco dust. In some countries, children are employed in tobacco farming, which impacts not only their health, but also their ability to attend school. Tobacco use can worsen poverty since tobacco users are at a much higher risk of falling ill and dying prematurely of cancers, heart attacks, respiratory diseases, or other tobacco-related diseases, depriving families of much-needed income and imposing additional costs for health care. The vast majority employed in the overall tobacco sector earn very little, while the big tobacco companies reap enormous profits. E-cigarettes are harmful to health and not safe. Children and adolescents who use e-cigarettes are at least double their chance of smoking cigarettes later in life. E-cigarette use increases your risk of heart disease and lung disorders. Nicotine in e-cigarettes is a highly addictive drug that can damage children's developing brains. Tobacco use, particularly smoking, takes your breath away. Tobacco use is responsible for 25% of all cancer deaths globally. Smokers are up to 22 times more likely to develop lung cancer in a lifetime than non-smokers. Tobacco smoking is a primary cause of lung cancer, causing over two-thirds of lung cancer deaths globally. 1 in 5 tobacco smokers will develop chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in their lifetime, especially people who start smoking during their childhood and teenage years, since tobacco smoke significantly slows lung growth and development. Smoking can exacerbate asthma in adults, restricting their activity, contributing to disability, and increasing the risk of severe asthma attacks requiring emergency care. Tobacco smoking more than doubles the risk of transforming tuberculosis from a latent state to an active state, and is also known to worsen the natural progression of the disease. About one quarter of the world's population has latent tuberculosis. Tobacco breaks hearts. Just a few cigarettes a day, occasional smoking, or exposure to secondhand smoke increases the risk of heart disease. Tobacco smokers have up to twice the risk of stroke and a fourfold increased risk of heart disease. Tobacco smoke damages the arteries of the heart, causing the buildup of plaque and development of blood clots, thereby restricting blood flow and eventually leading to heart attacks and strokes. Use of nicotine and tobacco products increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. Tobacco causes over 20 types of cancer. Smoking and smokeless tobacco can cause oral cancer, cancers of the lips, throat, pharynx and larynx, and esophagus. Surgical removal of the cancerous larynx can lead to the need for a tracheostomy, the creation of a hole in the neck and windpipe that allows the patient to breathe. Smokers are at significantly higher risk of developing acute myeloid leukemia, cancer of the nasal and paranasal sinus cavities, colorectal, kidney, liver, pancreatic, stomach or ovarian cancer, and cancer of the lower urinary tract, including the bladder, ureter, and renal pelvis. Some studies have also demonstrated a link between tobacco smoking and an increased risk of breast cancer, particularly among heavy smokers and women who start smoking before their first pregnancy. Smoking is also known to increase the risk of cervical cancer in women infected with human papillomavirus. Smokers are more likely to lose their vision and hearing. Smoking causes many eye diseases, which, if left untreated, can lead to permanent vision loss. Smokers are more likely than non-smokers to develop age-related macular degeneration, a condition that results in irreversible vision loss. Smokers also have a higher risk of cataracts, a clouding of the eye's lens that blocks light. Cataracts cause vision impairment, and surgery is the only option to restore vision. Some evidence suggests that smoking also causes glaucoma, a condition that increases pressure in the eye and can damage eyesight. Adult smokers are more likely to suffer hearing loss. Tobacco harms almost every organ of the body. Lifelong tobacco smokers lose at least 10 years of life on average. With every puff of cigarette, toxins and carcinogens are delivered to the body. At least 70 of the chemicals are known to cause cancer. The risk of developing diabetes is higher in smokers. Smoking is a risk factor for dementia, a group of disorders that result in mental decline. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and an estimated 14% of Alzheimer's cases globally can be attributed to smoking. Women who smoke are more likely to experience painful menstruation and more severe menopausal symptoms. Menopause occurs 1 to 4 years earlier in female smokers because smoking reduces the production of eggs in the ovaries, results in the loss of reproductive function, and subsequent low estrogen levels. Tobacco smoke reduces the delivery of oxygen to the body's tissues. Tobacco use restricts blood flow, which, if left untreated, can lead to gangrene, death of a body tissue, and amputation of affected areas. Tobacco use increases the risk of periodontal disease, a chronic inflammatory disease that wears away at the gums and destroys the jawbone, leading to tooth loss. Tobacco smokers are at a significantly higher risk than non-smokers for post-surgical complications. Tobacco smokers are harder to wean off mechanical ventilation. This often lengthens their intensive care unit and overall hospital stay, potentially exposing them to other infections. Smokers are likely to experience gastrointestinal disorders such as stomach ulcers, inflammatory bowel disease, associated with abdominal cramps, persistent diarrhea, fever, and rectal bleeding, and cancers of the gastrointestinal tract. Smokers are more likely to lose bone density, fracture more easily, and experience serious complications such as delayed healing or failure to heal. Components of tobacco smoke weaken the immune system, putting smokers at increased risk of pulmonary infections. Smokers with a genetic predisposition to autoimmune disorders are at an increased risk of several diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, bacterial meningitis, post-surgical infection, and cancers. Smoking also puts immune-compromised individuals, such as those living with cystic fibrosis, multiple sclerosis, or cancer, at a higher risk of disease-related comorbidities and premature death. The immunosuppressive effects of tobacco put people living with HIV at an increased risk of developing AIDS. Among HIV-positive smokers, the average length of life lost is 12.3 years, more than double the number of years lost by an HIV-positive non-smoker. Tobacco and nicotine use harm your baby. Tobacco use and exposure to tobacco smoke during pregnancy increase the risk for fetal death. Women who smoke or are exposed to secondhand smoke during pregnancy are at an increased risk of miscarriage. Stillbirth, delivery of fetuses that have died in the womb, are also more common owing to fetal oxygen deprivation and placental abnormalities induced by carbon monoxide in tobacco smoke and by nicotine in tobacco smoke and smokeless tobacco products. Smokers are at higher risk of ectopic pregnancy, a potentially fatal complication for the mother in which the fertilized egg attaches outside the uterus. Smoking cessation and protection from exposure to secondhand smoke are especially important for women of reproductive age planning to become pregnant and during pregnancy. E-cigarettes pose significant risk to pregnant women who use them as they can damage the growing fetus. Infants born to women who smoke, use smokeless tobacco, or are exposed to secondhand smoke during pregnancy have a higher risk of preterm birth and low birth weight. Tobacco pollutes the environment. Governments and local authorities pay to clean up tobacco waste, not the tobacco companies themselves. Quit tobacco to protect the environment. Cigarette butts are among the most commonly discarded piece of waste globally and are the most frequent item of litter picked up on beaches and water edges worldwide. Hazardous substances have been identified in cigarette butts, including arsenic, lead, nicotine, and formaldehyde. These substances are leached from discarded butts into aquatic environments and soil. Tobacco smoke can measurably contribute to air pollution levels in a city. A single tobacco smoker could contribute over 24,000 metric tons of methane or 5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide to the planet per year. E-cigarettes and heated tobacco products may contain batteries that require special disposal, as well as chemicals, packaging, and other non-biodegradable materials. Currently, the majority of plastic e-cigarette liquid cartridges are not reusable or recyclable. Transnational companies tend to sell disposable ones, presumably to boost sales via repeat customers. Tobacco production emissions are estimated to equate 3 million transatlantic flights. Tobacco smoke contains three kinds of greenhouse gases: carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxides, and pollutes indoor and outdoor environments. Worldwide, approximately 200,000 hectares are for tobacco agriculture and curing each year. Deforestation for tobacco growing has many serious environmental consequences, including loss of biodiversity, soil erosion and degradation, water pollution, and increases in atmospheric carbon dioxide. Tobacco growing usually involves substantial use of chemicals, including pesticides, fertilizers, and growth regulators. These chemicals may affect drinking water sources as a result of runoff from tobacco growing areas. For every 300 cigarettes produced, roughly 1.5 cartons, one tree is required to cure the tobacco leaf alone. With 6 trillion cigarettes manufactured annually, about 300 billion packages, assuming 20 cigarettes per pack, are made for tobacco products. Assuming each empty pack weighs about 6 grams, this amounts to about 1.8 million tons of packaging waste, composed of paper, ink, cellophane, foil, and glue. The waste from cartons and boxes used for distribution and packing brings the total annual solid post-consumption waste to at least 2 million tons. Okay, folks, well, if you're tobacco user and are interested in quitting, in Ohio, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Again, that's 1-800-QUIT-NOW to get some free expert advice and tips and assistance in quitting smoking or tobacco use. Okay, well, hopefully that coverage on diet and tobacco use cessation will be helpful in your New Year's resolutions. Okay, well, now I want to completely switch gears, and I want to do a story from Mad in America. Police involvement, a major racial justice issue in psychiatry. Law enforcement and police involvement in involuntary psychiatric commitments have been steadily increasing, which is concerning considering the role that racial bias plays in involuntary commitment. Identifying and implementing approaches to eliminating law enforcement involvement in mental health crises and involuntary commitment is key to a racially just and ethical care of those crises. Marvin Schwartz, professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University, writes, "When law enforcement officers are the first responders in a large proportion of mental health crises, something has badly gone awry. And as recently documented by the Treatment Advocacy Center, law enforcement members spend considerable time in commitment transport. When clinicians involuntarily commit patients in order to obtain cheap and secure transportation by law enforcement, racial justice is implicitly sacrificed on the altar of cost containment and defensive medicine. Systemic racism is embedded in mental health treatment and law enforcement. Racial bias has been demonstrated to influence the diagnosis of schizophrenia and substance addiction. Racially marginalized individuals, particularly black people, are more likely to become involved with mental health services through law enforcement and involuntary commitment than white people. This disproportionate care results from a lack of mental health training and education in law enforcement, racial discrimination, stigma, poverty, and lack of access to health care insurance. Despite their minimal training in mental health, police are oftentimes the first responders in mental health crises. The lack of appropriate training and education, coupled with racial discrimination, often results in police-sanctioned violence while attending mental health crises, particularly those involving persons of color. This raises questions about how we can identify and utilize approaches to mental health crises that limit law enforcement involvement and allow for a humane way of treating persons in crises. While civil or involuntary commitment procedures are outside of the criminal justice system's purview, there remains a reliance on law enforcement officials to transport individuals who are being involuntarily committed. This reliance is a major issue, as officers are being involved in situations that they lack the proper training to handle appropriately. Reliance on police officers for transportation places undertrained law enforcement officers to attend to individuals in crisis that they have not been taught how to manage. Further, lengthy waits for commitment evaluations on top of transport time places an additional burden on police officers who are already overtaxed. Swartz points to several crisis interventions that limit the involvement of law enforcement. Mobile crisis teams are one solution, as they can send trained outreach crisis teams to assist with mental health crises rather than law enforcement, only resorting to them as a last effort. Peer support programs also present as another alternative, as they employ individuals with lived experience in mental health issues who can assist with resolving crises. Moreover, co-response approaches to mental health crises involve police officers and mental health workers collaborating to de-escalate the situation and reduce any need for further law enforcement involvement. Another potential solution is having mental health professionals transport individuals to the hospital or using telehealth and conducting commitment hearings virtually to avoid law enforcement involvement. Others have called for anti-racist approaches to mental health care through cultural awareness, humanistic approaches, and treatment approaches that directly target racism. Overall, identifying and implementing approaches to crisis intervention and involuntary commitment that involves trained mental health professionals and reducing untrained police officers' involvement is crucial for adopting a way to address those in crisis with compassion and humanity while attending to racial justice. This is a perfect example of the slogan that's much maligned about defunding the police, which may not necessarily mean eliminating police budget, but what it means is using the appropriate social service provider for the appropriate social problem. And since mental health is not really a law enforcement problem, we should not be having law enforcement as the primary way of dealing with it. So this is a good example where a transfer of resources or an increase of resources relative to law enforcement into mental health care would be helpful for those that suffer from mental illnesses and the broader community as a whole. And in a somewhat similar note, also from Mad in America, getting at how medicines are not necessarily the best way to deal with mental health as well, is suicide rates did not decrease when antidepressant drugs were introduced. If antidepressant drugs worked to reduce suicide, we would see a decrease in suicide rates when antidepressants began to be widely adopted. This would be true around 1960 when the first generation drugs emerged, and even more pronounced around 1990 when the SSRIs exploded in popularity. To test this, researchers looked at suicide rates in three countries, Italy, Austria, and Switzerland, over time. They found that there was no association between these time periods and suicide rates. The drugs did not appreciably change suicide rates at all. The association between antidepressant drugs and suicidality is controversial. Numerous studies have found that antidepressant drugs actually increase the suicidality, especially in children and young adults. However, rarely some studies have found unclear results, indicating that antidepressants may not have an appreciable effect on suicidality either way in adults on average. Thus, increased prescription of the drugs is statistically associated with decreased suicide, but the trend had already started before the drugs were being used, so they could not be the cause of the decreased suicide rate. So we kind of make a presumption oftentimes in medicine that the medicines actually work, but we know that basically half or more of the medical interventions that physicians and healthcare workers use actually are not proven efficacious. And here's a very interesting study that gets at mental health from a more broader perspective, you could say a public health perspective, versus kind of a medical treatment approach. This also from Mad in America. Giving people money is more effective for mental health than brief therapy. A new study found that direct payments improved psychological well-being for those in poverty, while 5 weeks of therapy did not. A study with 5,756 participants from rural Kenya found that money, not therapy, was needed to improve psychological well-being. The researchers report, "Our main finding is that after 1 year, cash transfers have larger effects on economic and psychological well-being than the mental health intervention, which itself produces no improvements relative to control." The researchers compared four groups: people given cash transfers, people given 5 weeks of therapy, people given both cash transfers and therapy, and people given none of the interventions, the control group. The cash transfers consisted of $485, U.S. dollars, which has the purchasing power in rural Kenya of about 1,076 U.S. dollars. The researchers know that the per household cost of cash payments was less than the per household cost of the 5 weeks of therapy. According to the researchers, after 1 year, therapy had made no difference compared to the control group, but the cash transfer had increased psychological well-being and increased economic outcomes. The group that received both therapy and money had similar outcomes to the group that received only money, suggesting that therapy did not add anything useful. 1 year after the interventions, cash transfer recipients had higher consumption, asset holdings, and revenue, as well as higher levels of psychological well-being than control households. In contrast, the psychotherapy program had no measurable effects on either psychological or economic outcomes, both for individuals with poor mental health at baseline or others. One limitation of the study was that 5 weeks of therapy is a short duration and might not be long enough for positive effects to arise. However, the type of therapy used was Problem Management Plus, recommended by the World Health Organization as the flagship psychotherapy for low-income settings. Trained community health workers delivered it. Thus, the researchers did pick the most highly recommended and supposedly effective therapy for this situation. It is also possible that any effects of psychotherapy had dissipated by the one-year follow-up time period. Perhaps psychotherapy had a positive effect, but it simply does not last as long. However, this still provides a powerful contrast, since the less expensive intervention of direct cash payments did provide positive outcomes that lasted until the one-year follow-up. The study was also limited on its focus on people in rural Kenya, all living in poverty. It is unclear if the same effects would be found in high socioeconomic status populations or a Western population. However, the study's findings are consistent with previous research. A study in Lancet Psychiatry found that rising unemployment rates are linked to increased suicide rates. Another study found the same result for economic deprivation more generally. Yet another study found that each successive step of increasing exploitation of workers, such as overwork and wage theft, tripled the risk of psychiatric diagnosis. This is not even the first study of trying to give people money to improve outcomes. A 2015 study found that giving people in poverty about $73 per month was associated with improved outcomes. And as for whether psychotherapy is effective for people in poverty, a recent study found that people living in poverty had poorer outcomes from psychotherapy, which supports the current finding that therapy was insufficient for improving people's well-being. The implication is that talking with a psychotherapist can do little when people are deprived of the basic necessities of life. Money is a far more powerful tool in improving life. So there you go, people. Instead of paying for professional services for low-income, impoverished people, maybe just give them the money that those services would cost, and they may very well be better off. Somehow this seems kind of intuitive to me, but it's nice to see a research study that confirms it. Okay, well, I'd like to close the show with an article from Stat News that gets at another disease that we have in the medical system. So here we go. As a physician and a patient, I've seen the damage caused by the stigma of addiction. It must end. Although the disease of addiction is now obscured by the dark cloud of the COVID-19 pandemic, it continues to tear America apart. It's a relentless killer, fed by anxiety and uncertainty, and enabled by the attitudes of healthcare providers who are supposed to be caring for people with it. I led two lives for more than a decade. I worked as a physician caring for the sick and suffering. I also struggled with addiction, using cocaine and other drugs to manage post-traumatic stress, a consequence of surviving the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. I love my work, but the drugs kept me alive, managed my pain, and allowed me to function. This duality showed me how people with mental illness and substance abuse disorders are treated by my colleagues in the healthcare system. I saw their judgments and their scorn. I saw how U.S. drug policy was harming people right before my eyes. The term stigma comes from Latin and Greek words that mean a mark on the skin, often made by a hot iron. In ancient Greece, this mark identified criminals, slaves, and outcasts. People who couldn't be trusted, were dangerous, and had to be avoided at all costs. Today, people with addictions aren't physically marked with the equivalent of a scarlet A, but that doesn't make the emotional mark any less real. The stigma of addiction comes from the negative feelings that many healthcare professionals harbor for people struggling with substance use disorders, and their belief that poor personal choices, quote, moral failing, and defects of character are to blame for the disease. These feelings and beliefs mirror those of the general public. Healthcare workers may shame people with addictions more than others do. A study examining primary care physicians' perspectives on the prescription opioid epidemic found that most were unwilling to work closely with or have marry into their family a person with an addiction to prescription pain medication. The majority also believe that individuals with an addiction are dangerous and employers should be allowed to deny them employment, something that happens every day across America. Should a person with diabetes who struggles to control their blood sugar be denied the right to work, to provide for their family, or pursue their life's purpose? What about the person with asthma who smokes, or the person with heart disease who eats an abundance of fatty foods? A recent study exploring emergency physicians' attitudes towards patients with substance use disorders found that the majority had lower regard for patients with substance abuse disorders than for patients with other conditions affecting behavioral health. Among physicians participating in the survey, only 10% agreed that they, quote, enjoy giving extra time to patients like this. These physicians found it more rewarding to treat patients with obesity, diabetes, trauma, and even those with COPD who smoke. Healthcare professionals should know better and do better, but many don't, even though they have pledged to, quote, do no harm or injustice to those they serve. Stigma violates the right of people with addictions to be human, strips us of our dignity, and says to us that we have no value. It evokes feelings of shame so deep that they are hard to know unless you've experienced them. This kind of shame that guides us or tells us we made a mistake. It's toxic shame, the shame that tells us we are the mistake, something those of us with the disease come to believe. It tells us that we're never safe and keeps us silent, hiding, and alone, unvalued members of the human tribe. And that's how many of us with the disease die, hopeless, spiritually empty, and alone. Our healthcare systems have weaponized stigma in many forms, and it helps fuel America's crisis of addiction. In the very places that people with addictions hope to receive compassionate care, I have witnessed stigma unleash its power. The wrong word, a judging glance, or prolonged wait to receive care can be a death sentence. Healthcare workers have become the barrier to effective treatment. People with addiction see this, know this, and choose to avoid us in the healthcare systems we work in. The stigma we deliver to people with addictions isn't just a barrier to treatment. It also fuels the disease, continuing a deadly cycle that increases harm to people who use drugs and those of us in recovery. I have watched the actions of healthcare workers mark and discriminate, sometimes in plain sight, but mostly hidden, where it delivers maximum harm. The U.S. has waged its so-called war on drugs for decades. It has failed by every measure. Fueled by the iron law of prohibition and archaic drug policy, it was never really about drugs, but always about controlling people, especially people of color. In the past 2 decades, more than 750,000 lives have been lost to drug overdoses. The life expectancy of Americans has decreased, and the number of people in prison for drug offenses increased by more than 1,000%. We have criminalized a disease and punished the people who live with it, not just in prisons and jails, but also in our healthcare systems. The policies that drive the war on drugs and that dictate how the healthcare system cares for people with substance use disorders are deadly. They drive people with addictions into the shadows, where they hide to survive. It's a place I know well, as do many other healthcare professionals. Doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers have higher rates of substance abuse disorders than the general population, in some specialties, much higher. They're also more likely to have mood disorders, burnout, and compassion fatigue, and die from suicide. People who use drugs are marked and judged and confined to cages, cut off from each other, their families, and the connections that can help them heal. People don't die from overdoses, though that cause may be listed on their death certificates. They die from trauma and pain, and they die from stigma and the isolation and self-harm that follows. Restoring and maintaining supportive human connections between people with addictions and those people who help them can lead to recovery. This starts with facing stigma head on. I'm not talking about more buttons and posters, public relations campaigns, or storytelling. These do little to shatter the stigma that fuels the discrimination that takes lives. I'm talking about taking action to deconstruct the harmful policies that are the framework for a system that does great damage to those it claims to serve and those working in it. Addiction is a complex disease, and recovery from it is equally complex. There are many paths to improved health and recovery. It's not just about abstinence as the gold standard and Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous as the best way there. Any positive change should be celebrated. That might mean the cessation of drug use, but it might not. Sometimes the first step is using less of a drug, or using a safer drug, or using a drug in a safer way. Missteps should draw increased support, not punishment or isolation. More drug and alcohol treatment, medication-assisted therapy, and naloxone distribution are all steps in the right direction, but they will never be a solution to the addiction crisis. Policing patients with contracts, pill counts, prescription drug monitoring programs, and urine drug screens do little to help people with addictions. They serve the system and those working in it, not the people who seek compassionate care for a disease. Combating stigma within the healthcare system is vital to solving America's overdose crisis and improving the lives of those in recovery and those who continue to struggle with addiction. If we continue to rely on flawed drug policy and weaponized stigma, the overdose epidemic will continue to surge. the medical establishment, including professional boards, professional health programs, and medical groups and hospital systems, must take the lead and dismantle the policies that fuel stigma and punish patients and healthcare professionals for being human. Dismantling stigma and the policies that fuel it will take sustained and unified efforts across healthcare systems. Important first steps are addressing the language clinicians use when caring for people with addictions, better professional education about addiction for clinicians, integrating people with lived experiences with addiction into systems of care, and empowering them to help guide the policies and practices used each day for encountering and treating people with addictions. Healthcare professionals must use their voices to advocate for improved care for people with addictions, including their colleagues in substance use with substance abuse disorders. This includes advocating for compassionate drug policy based on science and expanding access to the evidence-based strategies proven to work. This means making harm reduction a priority. Addressing stigma and the diverse harms it delivers must be another priority. It will require reimagining the regulation and distribution of medications for substance use disorders and overdose. The current system is littered with barriers that reflect the belief that people with addiction don't deserve life. Healthcare professionals and policymakers need to rethink and reshape the Controlled Substances Act, legislation signed into law in 1970 that was less informed by science and more about waging a war on people. In its current form, the act drives the criminalization of addiction and the stigma that follows. It also deters healthcare professionals from treating those with the disease. Fear of surveillance, prosecution, and loss of license and career are powerful forces no practitioner can ignore. Our nation also needs a central acting guiding force, an agency whose priority is protecting the health, well-being, and rights of people who use drugs and those in recovery. That can help remove people with addictions from the criminal justice system, a place where no disease should ever be managed. Another priority is addressing the discrimination faced by people with substance use disorders, including healthcare professionals who struggle with this disease. They must be treated with the same care, compassion, and science used to treat any person with any disease. That currently isn't the case. If healthcare professionals can't address the stigma they direct towards their colleagues with addictions and give them high-quality care, they won't be able to do it for their other patients and will continue to fail when it comes to managing the disease. Unless we begin to value the human rights and dignity of people with substance use problems and those in recovery and continue to treat addiction as a mark of disgrace, we will never find a path forward for truly ending the war on drugs, and the disease of addiction will continue to tear America up. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you want to like the Facebook and get notified when I post the audio files online, just search for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.